Well, those of you who have been listening to Coast AM for a long time already know much of the work of Glenn Kimball. Always interesting, always entertaining. I'm sure that this show will be no different. And Glenn's big interests are many, but he has always been focused in one way or another to both ancient manuscripts, ergo his website, ancientmanuscripts.com, and also ancient Americans. That is to say, the story of Americans' prehistory, and for that matter, ancient American tourists, people who have come through and spent time for whatever reason and for whatever purpose in the Americas, and what they left behind, or in some cases, as in the in the story of a Scottish church that has images of cactuses or cacti from America in a church 100 years before Columbus even sailed, is that we're also interested in what these ancient American tourists took back or dropped off. And where we left off a couple years ago with Glenn Kimball was the dig going on in southern Illinois. We have the long-awaited update, and perhaps even the southern Illinois Rosetta Stone, so to speak, of ancient Egyptian tourists coming to the United States. So more on the latest research into ancient manuscripts and ancient Americans next with Glenn Kimball on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. Well, this is as much fun for me professionally as it is personally to talk with Glenn Kimball again. Hey, Glenn, you old son of a gun. How you doing?
My goodness, what a joy to speak with you again, Ian. You and I have been friends for a long time.
I'm going to be giggling for about a half hour just because it's so exciting for me to talk to you.
It's ecstatic for me, too.
Is your family well and everything good?
Yeah, I got married in the meantime between...
Get out!
I married just a wonderful lady. I swore on a stack of Bibles that I would never marry again. And the moment you do that, you know what the Almighty does to you, you know.
And that despite your graying mustache on your website?
I'm not so much concerned about the gray as the increasing shadow. and the magnetic force that I seem to be creating as I walk down the street with this immense mass.
Well, mazel tov on her, and glad to know that your life is still interesting and robust and full of new projects like this Bee Bible, which I'll ask you about later on. Mm-hmm. And I also want to ask you about, are you still involved with Ancient American Magazine?
Absolutely. Wayne Way and I speak all the time, and, you know, with my new venture in Mexico, I've been asked to do some research for a large investment group that's building a brand new city down there, and they are actually creating a city where none had ever stood before, and they asked me to name the town and to help create the museum and the artifacts will be there for the tourist attraction. And then what's most important is to sit on the board of the broadcast studios down there and be able to create content from that studio. It's the closest point from Phoenix to the ocean that there is, so it's going to be wonderful.
Well, I want to find out more about your Mexican project too later on, but let's start with where we last left off. And for people who don't know, let's start from the top, though, a little bit about what got you interested in what the early research was into expeditions into southern Illinois from ancient mariners?
Well, obviously last year, since we last talked to, I've been to Egypt, and I was a guest of the absolutely spectacular Princess Malik, who was the former queen of, before her husband died, of Morocco. She's the one that owns the King Tut exhibit. She invited me to Egypt, and we took a trip on her barge up the Nile, and she took me on a personal guided tour of Karnak. And what was amazing to me, she's just such an amazing person, is that she had such a connection with the Western world in terms of she had two near-death experiences that she talked to me privately about. And she met the same person I did in her near-death experience and swore, even though she's Islamic, swore that to her dying day that she would increase the knowledge of the great one who needs no name tag. But in Egypt, we were able to find obviously some of the stories of the thing that impressed me as I was in Karnak with the princess taking her personal guided tour right into the temple itself was how much these people worshipped boats. And I found out that there was a great difference between Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt. And the reason why they were separated, they were two separate cultures. The culture of Upper Egypt looked to the east as their homeland, which sank under the ocean in a cataclysmic explosion. And they called themselves the Red Men, just like our Native American Indians called themselves Red Men. Lower Egypt looked to the west as the ancestral homeland of their people, and they claimed that their homeland sank under the ocean before Menes, who was the one who was supposedly built the temple on the Giza Plateau. And so we're talking about people looking to the east and to the west, and ultimately where they were looking is a place called the Ultima Thule, which is the ultimate divide. This ultimate divide is located in India and Indonesia, where this land sank into the winy Red Sea. And it sank at the time of the explosion of Krakatoa in 11,600 years ago. But these people talked about four previous civilizations of humans on the planet that had been destroyed because of cataclysms that had happened. And the cataclysms had come because they had fallen out of favor with the teachings of their gods, so to speak, in much the same way, perhaps, as what happened at the time of Noah. But these men were men that lived a very, very long time and lived in a paradise. They called it paradise. They called it Eden, or Eden, amazingly, before Adam and Eve came into this Garden of Eden. And by the way, remember that Adam and his progenitors lived a very long time there until the time of the flood, which is the same lifespans of the people who were talked about from Egypt. This is no coincidence. This whole story has been tied in. What has happened since the final patriarchs, Adam and Eve, came into the world in our Western Christian philosophies? This same scenario has existed over and over and over again, and I found it fascinating. But in essence, we have found in recent days in Illinois, now this is quite surprising, another stone. I sent you a picture of it. It looks exactly like an Egyptian sarcophagus. It is very, very old. We haven't had it dated yet. We haven't had it in our possession that long to be able to have it dated. We're looking at maybe hiring one of the groups that did the analysis. There were three groups that did the analysis on the Shroud of Turin, and one of their groups is here in Arizona, at least some of the members that were in that body, to take a look at this stone to try and give us a date. But on the stone, which was found in a burial mound in Illinois, very near the cave, are pristine Egyptian hieroglyphs that can be read.
Well, now I want to stop there because I think we're still missing a piece for people who don't know the narrative thread of this. But the belief is that somewhere between those origins of which you speak, we have travelers coming into America, going up through the Mississippi, and then burying treasure, or what we would think of as treasure, in these mounds in southern Illinois.
And there are some 10,000 burial mounds in the Mississippi Valley. They're still there today. There's enormous archaeology that needs to be completed. To give you some sort of reference for your audience, one of the oldest documents in the world is the Book of Adam and Eve, written in Aramaic and found in Egypt, by the way, preserved by the Coptics, and we have good copies of it in English in our day. Adam and Eve exited this Garden of Eden in the West Gate. Now, most of the people talk about Cain, etc., leaving and to the east and going to the land of Nod. But the West Gate is kind of curious, because where is the West Gate? We have lost track of that in our biblical scenarios. The West Gate, when Adam and Eve left, they left to a place where there were caves, and these caves were caves of treasures. These were obviously places that had been occupied long before Adam and Eve came into the world, and people had buried their treasures, their archaeology. They had lived in these caves. They had worshipped in temples in these places. And it is my presumption and my thoughts, after having studied a variety of different manuscripts, that we might very well be talking about the Mississippi Valley. Because if you look at the word that traditional historians place the Garden of Eden in Iraq, I don't care where you go in Iraq, you don't find anything that looks remotely like a paradisal garden that with trees that didn't need cultivation, except along the very banks of the Tigris and Euphrates and the other four rivers that are there. It's not a lush garden. This is a sterile place to live, and has been for some 30 to 50,000 years. And it certainly has not been a lush garden since the end of the Pleistocene era in 11,600 years ago, the end of the last ice age. So we're talking about Adam and Eve living in some place that does not match up with what traditional historians think of in terms of the Eden or Eden.
But what does make sense for you is that that for whatever reason, these ancient Americans or ancient tourists came and either came and stayed or came and left, and left this footprint behind of these burial mounds. Now, we were talking about this over the course of years. You had, was it a German TV crew that was following you for a while, was it?
I don't know who they were.
I thought there was somebody that was doing a documentary on it, and I was looking forward to hearing more.
Well, we had a TV crew with us, but there's been somebody that has come to my housing unit here. They drive up in two brand-new Cadillacs. There's four guys in them wearing trench coats to the ground. And I'm sorry, you never need a trench coat to the ground in Phoenix, Arizona.
No.
Nobody in their right mind would wear that kind of clothing, winter or summer or any time. And they came in, they stuck high-def cameras through my window. And when I went out to try and invite them into my home, all they did was nod politely and walk back to the car very slowly, take their cameras, put them in the trunk, and drove slowly out of the parking lot. I don't know who those guys are.
I don't know either. Well, perhaps for another night when you find out more. But you were digging in southern Illinois, and at the time it was an undisclosed location because you were trying to keep as many people from coming and looking over your shoulder while you were doing it. You were
right.
Working in conjunction with other people. There were lawsuits. There were people fighting over this area and who was going to be able to uncover it. What did you eventually find there? Did you get to the bottom of what you were originally searching for, and what have you found since?
Well, we've taken several expeditions of ground-penetrating radar over the site, and found and mapped the underground caves, and found five statues and other kinds of square auditoriums. They're small. We're talking about 18 feet by 11 feet, something along those lines. But several rooms in succession down this 1,500 foot corridor. We have not dug the hole. We put the cameras down and verified that there is a cave down there. But we haven't dug the hole because the patriarchs who own this ground own 6,000 acres of corn. They have, their sons and daughters have been good people, but they have had alternate interests for this. They haven't wanted to have outside people come and mess with their ground. This sits on one of the most pristine groves of lumber in the Midwest. And in the meantime, since the last time we talked, both of the patriarchs have died alternately. The older patriarch and then his wife died and left the ground intestate. However, the son who is likely to inherit this and is in the will, and by the way, that will will be adjudicated hopefully by the end of October, and then we will be given final permission to do what we have to do to get into the cave. But the family itself hasn't been willing to sell us the ground. We made them an offer to buy it. That was withdrawn when the patriarchs died, and the ground has been intestate since that time. And we haven't got done what we needed to do. But in the meantime, we haven't stopped searching, nor have we stopped finding artifacts from that region.
All right. Now, your hope was and your thought was that, I mean, you could barely imagine what might be down there. The thought was that there would not only be many Egyptian artifacts, but also just gold and treasures that you thought could be, you know, priceless, including some reports of other artifacts that, as the local legend had said, had come from that area.
Now, they have actually sold. There's an underground black market of things that have come out of the burial mounds in Illinois. It's quite large, actually. The men who have been digging these things as pirates into the burial mounds have made livings on these artifacts that they've gotten out of it. They've gotten things like, they've even reportedly taken a Jewish menorah, a golden menorah, out of the caves. They've had precious stones taken out of a cave. But more importantly, they've had some 6,000 runestones upon which were detailed histories of people who had been up the Mississippi and lived along the banks of the Ohio or in southern Illinois, which is called Little Egypt to this day.
Down around Cairo, Illinois.
Yeah, around Cairo, Illinois, which is
right.
Was named after Cairo, Egypt.
Right.
I've been to both places, and they don't resemble each other at all.
Right. Locals don't pronounce it that, though. They call it Cairo, don't they?
Yeah, they call it Cairo.
Okay. And for that matter, then, the link to the University of Southern Illinois Salukis, the Egyptian racing dogs, which,
exactly.
Of all places, why that area would be so linked to ancient Egypt. Well, so have there been new finds, new statuary or anything else that you have come across in this black market that you think is linked to those burial mounds?
Without question. And the next episode or the next issue of the Ancient American magazine, which you can get at www.ancientamerican.com, will feature some of those particular items that we have located. So, and not the least of which is this magnificent Egyptian find, the prayer stone from one of the burial mounds in Illinois.
Well, and is that what you refer to as a type of Rosetta Stone?
It's not Rosetta Stone per se, because we can read Egyptian hieroglyphs very well. The most of the stones that I have seen, and I've seen hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, were written in a language that almost seemed like pidgin, Greek, Hebrew, and Egyptian mixed together. However, this is not the only place in the Americas where this particular style of writing has been located. Up in Michigan, they've had some runestones and petroglyphs in this language. In California and Utah, they've had it. And we've now located a professor who has deciphered the code and can read these documents, can read these writings. And they talk about migrations of people from the Near East and from Asia and from Egypt and from Jerusalem directly after the death of Christ, who were fleeing the Romans and the Sadducee persecutions, who fled up the Mississippi to get out of town because it was a dangerous place to be. And they were probably on the hit list. I remember that just after the death of Christ, with it, by the time of 70 AD, Jerusalem was in full-blown war with the Romans.
Sure.
And it was and just after that, the Jews and Christians were being taken to the Colosseum and served up to the lions.
Well, I want you to hold it right there, because when we come back, I want you to give me just a little preview of what you're going to have in this next edition of Ancient American. Tell me about it coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. And Glenn Kimball is back. So the update, for those of you that have been waiting for it, is that there are still problems getting this dig underway. There has always been a property issue. There has always been a sense of complication around the exact area where Glenn and others have wanted to dig. There was a time when it was very promising that there were cameras that were going down this shaft that were showing us something down there. There was verification from various technologies that appeared to be chambers and artifacts in them that you could see the outlines of that were clearly man-made. But still, as of this day, then, there is no new digging in that area, although Glenn is still optimistic that it'll happen. But what they do have from these sites is coming up from the black market. And Glenn's got some photographs and some things to tell us about, things that have been pulled out of the mounds of southern Illinois in this area that is to this day referred to as Little Egypt. We've talked a little bit about why it's called Little Egypt. We'll ask Glenn to give us a preview of what's coming up in the next publication of Ancient American. A run through these photos, including this prayer stone, which they refer to as a kind of Rosetta Stone, in quotes, at ancientamerican.com. We'll ask Glenn more about what they found coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. AncientManuscripts.com is Glenn Kimball's website, and it is from there that I still have several of Glenn's publications, and including the gift you sent me many years ago of the history according to Eusebius, which I use all the time still, and I think of you whenever I do, so thank you for that. And Glenn, I'm looking forward to asking you coming up about the so-called B-Bible, which is one of your new publications there. And you were on the cutting edge of this. You know, it's funny. There are I don't know, a half dozen books that have come across my desk in the last couple of years of people who are doing the same type of research that you were doing for years, kind of pre-Da Vinci Code, and suddenly a lot of this Gnostic material and these alternative texts came very much into fashion, and people were searching for this material. Hey, where can I actually read it? How can I find out more about it? And I had sent many people to your website because I knew that they could purchase it then. But then since then, many bigger books from bigger publishers have come out cataloging a lot of the material. So you are kind of way ahead of the curve on that one, Glenn.
Well, yeah, this is not an issue of jealousy for me. I tend to always be the Robin Hood of history, and I'm not surfing the wave. I'm out there in the ocean in front of the wave a lot of the times, and that's really not very satisfying because I had an experience this last week that was most pointed in this regard. Since I've been doing this research in Mexico, we had a visit from a man who. He calls himself the messenger. He lives with the six Mayan tribes that still live under the radar scope in the Yucatan Peninsula. These are tribes that have never been on CNN or ever been filmed in documentaries. They live primarily in the ruins that are only 5% of the ruins of the Yucatan Peninsula have ever been excavated. Or, for that matter, 5% of the ruins in South America have ever been excavated, and that's probably optimistic. There's probably more than that. But
they just can't find them? I mean, or they have them and no one's ever cataloged them? I mean, how? I'm surprised to hear anything hasn't been excavated.
They haven't even been cataloged. You know, I remember when I was a young man taking the bus ride from La Paz, Bolivia, down over the Andes into the Yungas, into the jungles of the Amazon. And as we were taking that, it almost was like the trip of Tarzan off the escarpment, you know. We were throwing with our huaracas, which were the ancient Aymara slings that you, like David's sling that he slew Goliath with. Mm-hmm. We were throwing oranges off the edge of the cliff, and the orange would disappear before it had hit the ground. That's how scary this ride was. But coming out of the side of these mountains were square stones the size of two buses side by side. And I remember asking the bus driver, well, what is this square stone doing here? He says, oh, well, that's just one of the thousands of ruins that have run around here all the time, you know. And I'm going, holy cow, how many of them are there? And over my years living in South America, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of locations there. And I actually had a chance to live in Mexico. And in addition to Chichen Itza and Teotihuacan and all of those sites which are famous tourist traps, there are thousands more. And there are some tribal people that still live under the canopy, the jungle canopy there, that are legitimate descendants of the Mayan culture, still speak the original Mayan languages. And guess who's one of the people who are some of the people who live with them? Giants, 9.5 foot tall boys. These are not thin little basketball players. These are muscular built people, one of whom came into town here about a month and a half ago into one of the little pueblos in the Yucatan, scared the people half to death, and by the time the CNN cameras got down there, he had already gone back home and they couldn't find him again.
Hmm.
But they have come and visited us because they have Mayan codexes, Mayan texts. They had 800 pages of them translated into Spanish. I speak Spanish. My wife is Mexican. And we're looking forward to someday telling the absolutely magnificent story of the ancestors of the Mayans. Of course, we know a lot of the tales already because of the Mayan codexes that exist in our day. We thought that the Indians never wrote anything. They most certainly did.
Well, I want to push it back a second. So this guy, the messenger who made contact with you, he represents these tribes, or is he a part of these?
He's not a part of the tribes. He went down there almost like Carlos Castaneda's did into Oaxaca, into Mexico, and he befriended the tribe. But what he did, and the reason why he became the messenger, is he would take the writings that he had found from one tribal elder to the other one. There are six shaman there that are over 100 years old that he walks continuously amongst these shaman, bringing them the writings, petroglyphs, artifacts from each of the other tribes so that they communicate with each other. And that way he's not the messenger to white Anglo-Saxons. He's the messenger within the tribal councils themselves. He's the bearer of the artifact and of the manuscripts amongst the tribes. And he comes up here twice a year, and we're hoping to have him lecture in our new town in Mexico. And also we'd like to have the shaman bring their artifacts and place them securely within the control of the Mexican government in the museums in Mexico. It's illegal to own Mexican artifacts in this country, and I highly am supportive of that. Because how many of us have gone to Mexico, including myself when I was young, and talked to the shaman? Camarino, who was the museum curator at Monte Albán, used to take me back to the shaman on several occasions, and I saw some of the artifacts at that time, and they gave me some of them. They gave me a stone statue, which was about a foot and a half high. It was a skeleton with a hollow head made out of stone, which was the symbol of death on the altar of Monte Albán in 1536. And along with that, he had a jade Madonna. This jade Madonna was over a foot high. Just the jade alone must have been worth a small freaking fortune. I told him not to give that to me, that I felt like that was a treasure beyond belief. I brought the symbol of death or the skeleton back with me, And when they passed the law that you could not have Mexican artifacts, I donated it to a museum. I have no artifacts, and I will have no artifacts.
Well, and I want to ask you about the other artifacts from the Little Egypt area in a moment, but I still got to get back to this Mayan tribe thing, because I find this so fascinating. And so this messenger fellow, could he lead you back to these Mayan tribes living underneath the canopy and to these 9.5 foot tall giants?
He wants to get permission from the elders. That's why I went back, to get us an invite.
Because, I mean, that would be some serious news for you to take, you know, even just like a camcorder in there and get something. You don't even have to have a big film crew on this at all.
No, you don't. You have to have some people who are not afraid. This is not like taking a trip into the wilds of Kansas, you know.
Right. I mean, what would you fear would happen? I mean, would these Mayan peoples be warrior types? Do you think they would do something to you, being an outsider?
Hey, listen, man. I followed Carlos Castaneda's into Oaxaca. You know who Carlos Castaneda is?
Yeah, sure.
I followed him into Oaxaca. That scared the living tar out of me right there.
I bet.
I met the brujas, you know, the witches, the shaman ladies. Nobody wants to do that in their life. It's in their right mind. I mean, when you're young and brave and you mm-hmm. think you want to see God and you want to see spirits and you want to see the spirits walk out of the hills and you sit at their campfires and you think, if I only could see that once in my life, trust me. Think twice before you do that.
Well, you know, but if you get the word out about 9.5 foot tall boys under the canopy, don't worry, you don't have to go in there. Just follow behind the NBA and college scouts. Just walk behind them.
We want a commission from the agent? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, let them walk point for you, and then you just follow behind them, and then we'll see what happens.
You are a commercial giant. You know that, don't you?
Yeah. All right, so back to the United States. So here in Little Egypt, in the area in southern Illinois, where there are thousands of these burial mounds, when I was raised in Illinois, I was taught to believe that these were all Native American mounds, but you believe that many of them contain artifacts which had to have been extra Native American, had to have come from some other source, including Egyptian statuary, and as you mentioned earlier, a menorah, and perhaps some early first or second century Christian artifacts too.
Right. And if you've been over in the Indiana, remember where the site where they have the dove carved in the hill there, the big dove, it looks like the Nazca lines?
I've heard about it. Right.
Well, I've been over there. If you go there, there's a museum right there, and this is going to answer your question. If you go to the museum, it has a picture of the Indians who carved this Nazca-like carving into the mountain. These Indians wore turbans. They wore sleeved shirts and pants. Now, that doesn't sound like Native American Indians in loincloths and feathers. This sounds like more than somebody that's coming out of Egypt. And I didn't do that. I mean, that's on the museum. That's portraying the Native Americans who carved this thing. As a matter of fact, they talked about the people who came over on the Mayflower, that some of the Indians that they found weren't loincloth-bearing Indians either. These were people that were wearing shirts and pants and turbans as well. So where did these people come from? I mean, they're Native American Indians, and by the way, Christopher Columbus may not have been so stupid in calling them Indians because they call themselves the Red Men. The land of the Red Men, or the Rutas, or the Rot or Kem in Egypt, the Phoenicians called themselves the Red Men. These were men who came from the epoch of the Atlantean destruction 11,600 years ago. So the Native American Indians is not such a dumb idea. It really is the land of the Red Men was in the Indonesian islands in India, and certainly the Native American Indians have looked to their far distant ancestors as coming from that area of the world. certainly vindicating another age of time, another people, but mixed in with these tremendous legends of Atlantis is something very curious, because these people, first of all, believed that their civilization was destroyed. Plato says it very clearly in his comments on Atlantis. He says these people were destroyed because of sin or wickedness. Pardon me for the religious allusion. But all four of the civilizations of men that have been recorded in the past, all were destroyed for similar reasons. But also, you take books like the Ramayana, who talks about the Shambhala. The Shambhala was the great white knight who would come at the end of the world and lead the sons of God against the sons of darkness, the sons of light against the sons of darkness in one great Armageddon-like battle. Who was that guy? I mean, that seems to be very much rooted in the traditions of the West as well.
Well, and all very interesting. What have you found then, and what has popped up? What do you have photographs of? What's being circulated around on the black market that ties into this area, Little Egypt?
Every single issue of the Ancient American magazine is filled with photos of what we have found, what Wayne has found predominantly, and what we have been showing the world. Wayne is right on top of that. He's the owner of the Ancient American magazine. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pictures in these issues. By the way, it's sold at Barnes & Noble now because of its popularity. But you can get a hold of Wayne at ancientamerican.com. It's very close to ancientmanuscripts.com. If you want to get to it, you can go to my website and click on magazines, and it takes you right there. Or you can go to the Coast to Coast website and get there as well.
Are we talking about, like, what we would think of as maybe like a Sphinx or Nefertiti's, or what kind of things are there that have come up recently out of the black market?
There's some Egyptian motifs, which with definite, you know, one of the runestones that we have is what I call the Stone of Melchizedek, because it says Melchizedek in this pigeon Greek language that they have right on the side of the document. It has this very, very Egyptian-looking man with an Egyptian tunic on and an Egyptian headdress on, standing between two pillars, which, by the way, we want to talk about the two pillars, because the pillars of Hercules are totally significant in the story of not only Atlantis and Alexander the Great, but in the building of the Temple of Solomon. Remember, the two pillars that were outside that temple even had a name given to each one of them. How many people name a pillar in their temple? But they call them Boaz and Joachim. These pillars were totally significant. But on this runestone, there are two pillars, and on the side, it identifies this man as being Melchizedek. So that has been found. We have a great motif of the head of a pharaoh. We have a great a runestone with the head of a Maori sailor, which is a black African sailor from the first century off the northern coast of Africa, in this collection. We have great symbols of Christ on the cross. We have great symbols of Jewish warriors that are found that were at the time of the first century. We have great Roman motifs, Roman army people, basically soldiers that are found in these stones in Illinois. And, you know, why historians have denied that any of these things have ever existed, and yet in history there was the Cave of the Mouth, which Wayne took me to up the Mississippi, which we used to be covered with Egyptian hieroglyphs. And we went up the Mississippi to find that, and we did find it, and today most of those have been destroyed. But historians don't like this. They do not like the fact that these things have ever existed. I even think about Buffalo Bill Cody, when he, you know, the one that did the Old West show.
Sure, the Wild West shows.
He was brought by Sitting Bull some bones of giants from Sitting Bull and his nation, and he was told that these were the men from the epoch before our epoch of time. And he took these bones and gave them under protectorship to universities, and they never have surfaced again. But Buffalo Bill Cody writes of these things.
Well, I want you to hang on to that thought, because I know that you talk about the role that giants play in the beliefs between Upper and Lower Egypt too, and maybe we can tie all these together. And what epoch are we entering into now, as we are rolling out of one into another? We'll ask Glenn Kimball about that next on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett.